Good morning and welcome to another edition of Radio in Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM-LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. My name is Ernie Hood. I'm a freelance science writer, and the purpose of the program is to bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science, both here in the Triangle and elsewhere. Each week, we focus on one particular scientific topic of interest, talk to an expert on the subject, and give you the opportunity to call in with your questions or comments. You're welcome to do that at any time, and you can give us a call at 929-9601. If you happen to be listening on the internet, just add the area code to that, and that area code is 919. And we've recently put up a website for the program, which you can access at home.earthlink.net/radioinvivo. Our topic today is HIV and AIDS, specifically the training of medical professionals in how to treat and manage the disease. And we do have an expert on the subject joining us on the program today, Robin Swift, who is the Training Sector Director of the North Carolina HIV-AIDS Training Center, which is housed within the Health Inequities Program of the Center for Health Policy, Law, and Management at Duke University. And I'm sure Robin will straighten all of that out for us. Robin has a master's degree in public health with a concentration in health education from Emory University in Atlanta, and a BA in American Studies from UNC Chapel Hill. With that in mind, Robin, how in the world did you end up at Duke?
I followed a job there, and I never stood in line for basketball tickets as a student, so I don't have to do it now.
Excellent. Well, Robin, tell us about your group at the North Carolina HIV-AIDS Training Center. What is the group's mission, and what kind of activities are you involved in?
Beginning in the mid-80s, when the Ryan White Care Act was funded to provide publicly funded care for people with HIV, some wise federal bureaucrat decided that to build into that act a capacity to keep healthcare providers tuned up in their knowledge so that they could provide state-of-the-art care no matter whether they practiced in a small rural clinic or in a big infectious disease clinic. So we have a subgrant from the AIDS Education and Training Regional Center at Emory, and our mission is to train healthcare providers in about six categories across the state of North Carolina in state-of-the-art care.
And what types of medical professionals do you serve with your programs?
Physicians, mid-level care providers, nurse practitioners and PAs, nurses, pharmacists, dentists, and dental hygienists.
I see. And are these professionals mainly specialists in HIV and AIDS, or do you reach out further than that?
We'll reach out to whomever's interested in the topic. We tend to focus our training on the publicly funded clinics, which North Carolina has a wealth of, scattered around. But our workshops are open to all comers who are clinicians interested in HIV.
I see. How difficult is it for the non-specialist to keep up with the state of the art today when it comes to HIV and AIDS? How are things changing quickly?
I think it's getting easier. What my colleagues at the infectious disease clinics at Duke and UNC remind me is that a base patient caseload of about 30 patients is the sort of cutoff for making it worth your while to try to keep up with how quickly things develop. That if you see fewer patients than that, you may want to refer them onto a specialist who sees more and stays tuned up just as a function of their regular job. Mm-hmm. But the internet, the medical journals, the pharmaceutical companies all make high quality education accessible, and it can be learner directed or in large groups, sort of depending on what you need.
I see. Is it part of your mission to help to dispel myths and misconceptions about the transmission of the disease or its outcomes or treatments?
Yes, very definitely. And we often invite larger audiences than just clinicians to come in. Clinicians who are treating HIV are usually pretty comfortable with its ease of transmission and the groups of folks who tend to be affected. But people in smaller areas or with smaller practices may have less comfort. And so we spend time if the audience seems to need it on that kind of education.
I see. Robin, why is it so important for medical professionals to stay current in their knowledge?
Well, I was first drawn to AIDS 18 years ago by how cutting edge it was, not just in its integration of infectious diseases and immunology and oncology, but also in the sort of social medicine aspects of HIV care. And the problems faced by people who are presenting with HIV have not gotten less pressing over time. Mm-hmm. So there are a high demand client load, and they're going to be in care, thankfully, for all of their adult lives if we do a good job of providing that care. And the virus adapts quickly to the medicines that we invent to treat it. So you have to keep up because your patients are going to need new therapies every 2 to 3 years.
It's changing that quickly.
It changes. Well, the virus changes that quickly.
Right, sure. As the distiller of information that is constantly changing, I assume, or updating, what kind of process do you and your group use to distill the massive amounts of information coming down the pike constantly and turn that information into validated training programs?
What we do is hire the treatment experts, and in North Carolina we are blessed with lots of them at Wake Forest Baptist, at UNC, at Duke, and at East Carolina. And then there are a number of private practitioners who've maintained large AIDS practices around the state as well. So when we organize an event, we'll ask the coordinator at the site what the audience needs, and if they're not entirely sure, we'll survey the audience about exactly what they need. And then we hire training consultants to match those needs. And we, as I said, we have experts, nationally recognized experts to choose from.
I see. And are they generally available?
Yes, with enough warning, yes. And they're very generous about doing it. But they're also often the sources of referral for the people who are in their audience. So it really is a community service that goes in both directions. If they can be the recognized training source, then they'll often be the person that a local clinician will call for consultation, and the circle enriches itself.
I see. Actually, the consultation aspect was something I wanted to ask you about as well, because I saw that from your materials that your group also does offer clinical consultations or one-on-one assistance with clinical decision-making for individual patients. What kinds of situations arise that create the need for that level of service? And what kinds of advice do you tend to offer?
I'm not a clinician, so I'm going to kind of draw that boundary around my answer. But
sure.
For example, more and more patients are presenting with comorbidities of hepatitis C infection, mm-hmm. and a practitioner who hasn't seen that before and doesn't know whether or not they can offer treatment for hepatitis C to a patient with HIV will want to call an infectious disease specialist, or may want to have an experienced clinician come into their clinic and see a number of patients with them so they can get comfortable with, are we doing the right labs? Are we doing the right follow-up? Is our appointment interval appropriate?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I imagine that's a very valuable service out in the wider world then.
That your tax dollars at work, yes.
Well, it's nice to see our tax dollars going for a good cause. My guest this morning on Radio In Vivo is Robin Swift from the North Carolina HIV/AIDS Training Center, and we are talking about HIV and AIDS and the work that she and her group conduct at the training center. And you are welcome to join us at 929-9601. Robin, how prevalent is HIV and AIDS in North Carolina at this point? Is the infection rate rising? If so, how fast? And how is that breaking down demographically these days?
North Carolina, along with the other states in the Southeast, has a growing HIV epidemic. In fact, we spend a lot of time advocating for additional funding for this region of the country because our epidemic has grown so fast. Our state has had about 1,000 new cases a year for the last 3 years, which is significantly higher than the national average. And the demographics, the change from 15 or 20 years ago is a larger number of women who are infected via heterosexual transmission, a large number of cases in folks who have used both injecting drugs or who have sold sex to use other drugs and alcohol. We have a very high rate of HIV infection in African American men and women in North Carolina, and it's a huge concern for us.
Of course. So one thing I wanted to ask you about is I came across a study about the potential increased prevalence on college campuses. Could you comment on that?
Yes, that was a mini epidemic sort of discovered by accident from researchers at UNC here in Chapel Hill who began implementing a way to test folks for early primary HIV infection before they developed antibodies. And when they, what they do is for every person coming to present themselves to a public health department or publicly funded testing site for a test who tests negative, they pool those negative blood samples and test them for viral RNA. And they can find, after a series of pooled tests, folks who have evidence of virus but don't yet have evidence of antibody. And they discovered that a number of those initial cases were among college students, which was a huge surprise. They didn't sort of expect that the epidemic was as widely distributed in the population as it has been.
So epidemiology at its best.
Absolutely. And a real sort of national model for an approach to finding infection early, getting folks enrolled in care very early and at the point where they're most infectious to other people. So a sort of penultimate teachable moment for folks who aren't aware of their HIV risk often.
So these are people generally that are still asymptomatic.
Right. Or they have the acute symptoms that can develop within about 14 days of infection that mimic mononucleosis or meningitis. So one of our training efforts this year is to try to educate outpatient clinic and emergency room providers to think acute HIV when a patient presents with those kinds of symptoms and go ahead and offer a test.
I see. Are you also targeting university infirmaries?
Yes, we are. In fact, there's a presentation going on as we speak at North Carolina Central about acute HIV.
So this is also, as you mentioned, when people are most highly contagious and most likely to potentially spread the disease, given that they are as yet unaware that they have it.
That's right.
So is that going to be a relatively important development in the bigger picture?
I really think so. And North Carolina has sought funding to continue that program and expand it and create a national model. And the hope is that CDC will encourage and fund other states to do the same kind of testing.
Robin, you talked about how the epidemic is rising. I think you said 1,000 new cases a year, roughly, and that is higher than the national average. Is that level of infection putting a strain on the ability of our healthcare system to deliver services and treatment effectively?
It absolutely is. Most of the services that were designed to provide AIDS care were designed when patients were in care for maybe 18 months to 4 years because they only lived that long. We didn't have these very expensive and very effective treatment drugs.
Sure.
We now have to retrofit those programs to provide for much longer interactions with patients. Mm-hmm. And the patients who are coming to us have multi-layered problems that are outside of the scope of infectious disease care, but without their being treated, for example, mental illnesses like depression or substance use, without the ability to treat those comorbidities, we can't help people stay on the medications that will keep them physically well.
So these days, then, given that it's become a chronic condition as opposed to a death sentence. As you say, the term of treatment is long-term and extended out, and the comorbidities have almost become, in a way, more difficult to deal with than the HIV itself. Is that about right?
I would agree, and funding, since we have these wonderful new therapeutic agents, the cost of providing the kind of medical care that gets people to those drugs and keeps them on those drugs is really driven by the need to get them on drug therapy, because the outcomes are so much better when people are in care. So the programs that initially developed to be comprehensive social service and ancillary treatment programs have had to make decisions about how to spend money, and the federal government urges that they do so in the direction of medical care, because that seems to be the wisest use of those dollars. So as the population grows, for example, Charlotte, North Carolina, has a federally funded HIV clinic and a number of really wonderful infectious disease clinicians who provide care, some of which they're not even reimbursed for. But if they're going to see 500 new patients in a year and they're already maxed out with the patient population they have, there isn't much expansion built in mm-hmm. to the federal funding programs that keep us all going.
Sure. So what is the answer in that kind of situation?
Well, the first answer is that the Ryan White Care Act is up for reauthorization. And so for folks who are interested in advocacy for AIDS funding, advocate. Secondly, states need to continue to raise tax revenues to take care of their people with HIV. And it's not a problem that most state legislators are really comfortable funding.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And thirdly, health funds, domestic health funds in HIV are not expanding at the rate that they need to. President Bush has wisely focused on intervening in the international epidemic, but we need to make sure that that doesn't happen at the expense of the epidemic that hasn't gone away at home.
Sure. And so what do you see as the prospects for continued expansion of the funding, or at least continued at the present levels, if nothing else?
I think that CARE Act will probably be reauthorized, and the difficulty will come in funding pharmaceutical care. And the Medicare Part D developments have sort of added to those difficulties, not in ways that I'm very articulate about. I'm just aware that a couple of friends with AIDS are now having more difficulty getting their medications than they were before Medicare Part D was initiated.
Mm-hmm.
And I still think until HIV happens to somebody that you know and love, it's not an issue for most folks. It's that nexus of sexuality and fear of dying and substance use and personal behavior that we're not comfortable as a society talking about much.
You don't think we've made at least some social progress as far as that goes? I mean, I remember when the disease first came on the scene, I guess back in the 80s, people were talking about it as, you know, God's revenge on homosexuals. Do you think we have gotten away from that or progressed past that kind of attitude yet?
I think we have. We may have fallen in a new ditch, which is that believing that the medications that keep somebody well essentially act as a cure, so that people really don't need to worry about their personal behaviors because there's a way to treat this if you get it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really not true.
Sure. And I'm going to ask you about that in more detail in a little while. Robin, how does turning back to the medical professionals that deal with this, how does the average non-specialist, say an internist, deal with HIV/AIDS on a day-to-day basis? Do they have a lot of people who are presenting with this? And when do they perhaps understand that they have reached the limits of their own knowledge and ability to handle this effectively?
Well, it's interesting. There's been a sort of tennis ball effect of who ought to be caring for people with HIV that's bounced back and forth across the court numerous times since the 80s when care became available. What we would really love for the average internist to do is keep their level of suspicion high and do the kind of patient education that normalizes routine HIV testing, so that every time you come in for your annual physical or you present with a symptom that might suggest either that you've had sexual activity with a new partner or that you may have something going on with your immune system, your doctor feels comfortable saying to you, "Ernie, let's take an HIV test," and gives you the education to help you feel that that's fine. We, by law, offer the HIV test to every pregnant woman in North Carolina and are trying to normalize offering the HIV test to every woman coming in for a family planning or OBGYN visit. Again, a great role for an internist. You can manage early HIV infection once you've drawn the labs appropriately and sort of figured out what your patient needs, sort of up until the point where their immune system starts to decline, and then you're going to want some help from a more experienced specialist. But the hope is over time that you will co-manage this patient. People are much more comfortable getting their care close to home than having to drive for 2 or 3 hours to a major medical center and wait for 3 or 4 hours once they get there. So our hope is to keep the average doc well enough educated to know when to hand off. And that's usually when you start medications and you're monitoring them, or you need to change medications, or the patient's getting worse and everything that you're trying isn't really working.
I see. So that's actually an important part of the mission of your group, correct?
Exactly.
Okay. Our guest this morning on Radio In Vivo is Robin Swift, who is with the North Carolina HIV-AIDS Training Center, which is located at Duke. And they are responsible for training medical and healthcare professionals in how to keep up with the latest science on HIV and AIDS and helping to deal with treatment and management. Robin, we've talked about the average clinician. What about the average patient? How are patients faring with this disease these days?
It really depends when they come in our door, how they fare. The patient whose illness is discovered early while their immune system is still pretty intact fares beautifully. Sometimes the medications initially are hard to take. They can cause headache or nausea or diarrhea, but those symptoms tend to abate over time if someone can tolerate medication and they can look and feel well for a really long time. Our worry now is that patients are presenting late, already with opportunistic infections or cancers, so that you're doing a lot of salvage care and their immune systems aren't, it's sort of back to the early 80s, that kind of presentation. So we, again, normalizing testing and getting people to think, gee, this is something I ought to look out for on a regular basis, would help us get people early and keep them well for longer.
You say that patients are presenting later with more opportunistic infections. Why do you think that is?
People don't think of themselves at risk, or they're afraid to know that they have HIV infection, or other issues in their life are far more pressing than their health.
Is it now that it is considered more of a chronic disease, people worry about it less?
I think maybe that's true, yeah.
So there's really less public awareness as well.
Well, notice how little you read about AIDS in the media, except perhaps about AIDS overseas. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be that it was on the cover of Newsweek every 18 months or so, and there were kind of public icons.
Sure.
And nobody since Greg Louganis and Magic Johnson has really stepped forward to say, "I'm living with HIV, and I want to be a sort of spokesperson."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In terms of the patients, particularly in this area perhaps, you've talked about how they're faring medically. How are they faring socially and economically? Is it difficult to get the appropriate insurance coverage?
Yes, it's still really difficult to get the kinds of benefits you need as a person with HIV, and the benefits programs that used to be widely available to people with AIDS are not available to people who are earlier in stages of their infection. North Carolina also has the our criterion for our AIDS Drug Assistance Program, which is funded under the Ryan White Care Act, is that your income has to be at 125% of poverty. That's lower than, that's poorer than any other state in the nation.
So are there patients out there who are falling through the cracks and not receiving adequate treatment?
If they're enrolled in care, it's really my strong belief that they're getting adequate care.
One way or another.
If they're not enrolled in care, yes, they're definitely falling through the cracks, and it takes a while to get all of their ducks lined up, to get them into a clinic to be seen, to get them enrolled in drug assistance programs, to get them linked up with a case manager in their region who can help them navigate through the system.
So this is a multidisciplinary approach, not only in terms of the clinical management, but just in terms of the management of making sure that people have the appropriate care available. Is that correct?
That's really correct. The larger group I work in at Duke, the Health Inequalities Program, has three separate arms. Its primary arm is research and evaluation. And my boss, Dr. Catherine Wetton, has done a lot of research on the sort of social history drivers behind the AIDS epidemic in our region. We also have a number of projects that develop and test models of care and what makes them effective, and we have this training arm and a huge evaluation capacity. So it's a multidisciplinary group that really believes in making community partnerships. So we're infused with information from all over the place, and it's one of the reasons that work there is so compelling.
I can imagine so. How much outreach into the community do you folks do, or do you focus your efforts mainly within the medical professions themselves?
My funder, the Health Resources and Services Administration, has delimited the HIV Training Center project to only clinical care providers, but we have a small contract with the State Health Department to train AIDS case managers, and we will often do other community trainings if asked, if we're going to sort of reach a group that we haven't reached otherwise. The capacity for training, which was pretty rich between the mid-80s and the early 90s, has kind of fallen away as resources have been diverted toward care. So there aren't a whole lot of training resources for the community at large or for other kinds of providers.
I see. Do you get asked for that kind of service very often?
I think we've begun to say no enough times so that we don't. But we try to refer people to health departments, the Red Cross, or other agencies that can step in and do a good job.
So there are resources available.
There are resources available.
That is good to know. In your experience, Robin, what are you finding to be the kind of average level of knowledge of the medical people that you work with in training? Are they typically pretty well informed, or do you see gaps in their knowledge that perhaps are a bit surprising?
No, I'm delighted with how well informed people who are doing HIV care tend to commit to being. And how hungry they are for new material when it's available, and how generous they are about sharing information with each other.
I see. Very good. We are going to take a short break here, and then we are going to come back and broaden the conversation a bit and talk about the disease in general and where we stand with it. We'll be right back. Of course, science does have its lighter side, and each week here on Radio In Vivo, we feature some of the more amusing scientific stories that have come to our attention in a segment we call One Step Beyond. Sometimes important discoveries can arise from the most bizarre investigations. This one is a perfect case in point. You've heard the expression, as rare as hen's teeth, right? Well, now scientists in the UK have discovered that rarest of all things, a chicken with teeth. Apparently, there is a naturally occurring mutant chicken called a talpid that has a complete set of ivories, teeth that are similar to a crocodile's, which is not surprising since birds are the closest living relatives of crocodiles. There's a really cheesy sci-fi movie in here somewhere, especially if these mutant chickens ever decide to attack. But that's unlikely, because typically these mutants have severe defects and die before they hatch, which is why it took so long for anyone to notice that they had teeth. This discovery led the researchers to induce the growth of teeth in normal chickens by activating genetic pathways that have lain dormant for 80 million years. So apparently chickens have been capable of producing teeth all along, but have inexplicably chosen not to do so. A foul plot is suspected. Sorry. It sounds silly, but this could actually have important implications for efforts to develop tissue regeneration in humans. This would include the ability to regrow teeth, as well as other applications, by activating specific dormant pathways to stimulate regeneration instead of repair. One application of all this that's already in commercial development is a company called Renovo, which is developing novel pharmaceuticals for the prevention and reduction of scarring. So the next time the chicken crosses the road and bites the hell out of you, not to worry. Pretty soon, you just might be able to heal the wound without a scar, thanks to tissue regeneration research. Join us again next week on Radio In Vivo for another exciting edition of One Step Beyond. Okay, we've got that silliness out of the way for another week. Welcome back to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community. And this is WCOMLP. My name's Ernie Hood, and my guest this morning is Robin Swift from the North Carolina HIV/AIDS Training Center. And we've been talking about the program the center runs, or programs, educating medical professionals about the disease. And Robin, I'd like to turn out now, as I said, a little bit more generally to the disease itself and where we stand. What is the state of the science right now concerning HIV/AIDS?
On the positive side, treatment's getting easier. Thanks to the 3x5 project at the World Health Organization and the work of the Clinton Foundation and PEPFAR, there have been a big push to streamline drug therapies into pills that a patient can take one or two of once or twice a day. This is as opposed to some therapies in patients with advanced disease here, where people may be taking 12 or 15 pills a day. They have to refrigerate some, take others on an empty stomach. So the pharmaceutical developments keep moving quickly, and I think that it's going to make it easier for people to adhere to this fairly difficult and demanding regimen. I think the other thing is HIV really is chronic, and you can live with it for a very long time, and healthily, and making a positive contribution to your own family and to society at large. One controversial development in the epidemic that I think of as positive, but not everyone will agree, is what's called PrEP, post-risky exposure prophylaxis, the use of antiretroviral medication after a risky sexual exposure to prevent transmission, possibly, like morning after pills. This is not widely available. It hasn't been licensed by the FDA, I hasten to caution.
Sure.
But a possible development in the next couple of years.
Now, I had not heard about that. Tell us more about that. Is that something that can prevent the infection from taking hold after risky behavior has been?
We don't know.
So
I think there are a number of clinical trials that are going to attempt this, but it's a tricky trial to do just in case it doesn't work.
Yeah, indeed.
I think some other positive developments are condoms are getting easier to use, more pleasant to use, and there's, for example, a polypropylene male condom, similar to the polypropylene female condom, and female-centered prevention methods are being researched, and particularly here at UNC, there's a number of international researchers, and in the research triangle as a whole, working on how to give women the power both chemically and behaviorally to prevent HIV.
Is that something RTI is involved
RTI
with?
RTI is...
Research Triangle Institute. International. Thank you.
Family Health International.
Family Health International. Right.
And then researchers at UNC School of Medicine.
So with the Triangle really does have a huge international presence in those kind of terms in HIV AIDS.
And what's really neat is also clinics at ECU, UNC, and Duke send clinicians to African clinics to staff and resource them, and also to learn what works in rural areas and bring those insights back to North Carolina. So there's a deep commitment to sharing the kind of high-quality care that's available here with folks who have fewer resources.
Sure. Before we get beyond it, I want to ask you a little bit more about the PrEP, post-risky...
Exposure prophylaxis.
I thought I had it. is that regimen taking antivirals, protease inhibitors, quickly after you have engaged in something you perhaps shouldn't have?
At the street level, where the social experiment is going on, there are rumors. I don't have much of a street life anymore.
This is good.
There have been rumors about Viagra parties where folks take Viagra and a lot of crystal meth, have lots of sex, and then share antiretroviral prescriptions so that they can prevent the possible spread of HIV. But there's no standard protocol that I know of for post-risky exposure prophylaxis. So again, don't try this at home. We don't know if it works.
Right.
It isn't licensed by the FDA. And if you are a person with HIV or who is involved in risky activities, please talk to your clinician about how to protect yourself.
But this is actually something that is being scientifically
looked
at.
I don't know if there are trials going on, but it really changes our attitude about anticipating HIV and how we're going to think about it. And again, that this disease has been so dynamic in 20 years. It's a specialist disease. It's a generalist disease. You can't treat it in the developing world. You must treat it in the developing world. So things keep changing.
Well, that's certainly true. And I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, where are we in terms of the research in our understanding of the inner workings of this incredibly dynamic and complex virus? All of those inner workings which make it so incredibly virulent and adaptable.
That is, in its weird way, the gift of HIV for us. We had never seen a human retrovirus before with distribution patterns like the ones that HIV displays. And we have now, thanks to genetic sequencing and virologic research, been able to map out how the virus interacts with cells at every level, from when it first gets through their outer protein till it inserts itself in the cell's DNA and reproduces. I think the benefits to the larger society are legion in our understanding of immunology and our understanding of the way viruses work and our ability to test and our ability to develop antibody tests quickly. And the example I use is how quickly SARS, which is not the same kind of infection, was mapped and understood and able to be tracked.
With that level of understanding that we have of how the virus works at this point and its interaction with our cells, is there some kind of magic bullet on the horizon at this point in terms of our understanding that may eventually constitute a cure or even more effective control of the disease?
Vaccine research keeps going and is pretty well funded. So I think clinicians and researchers are optimistic that there is something that we can do that will stop HIV.
I see. We've heard, you talked about a vaccine, and we've heard talk about work on a vaccine for many, many years. But as of this point, none have yet emerged in general use, at least. Are we any closer to a vaccine being perfected and proliferated?
I think we are. And as I said, that research is going on not only domestically in the U.S., but internationally. And at every international AIDS meeting, there's more conversation about an attenuated approach to vaccination. So I think people have not given up. They've been disappointed that it didn't emerge quickly, but more optimistic that the more they understand, the more they can tweak solutions that are appropriate.
So would you see that type of thing coming down the pike, say within the next 5 to 10 years, perhaps?
Maybe the next 10 to 20 years. Okay. Maybe not the next 5 to 10.
Seems like we heard that 10 to 20,
10
years,
20
ago.
Years ago. Well, this is really complex stuff. And I think the concern I have as a health educator, not as a clinician, is we would all love to believe that someone could magically stand on the headboard of our beds or the dashboards of our cars and protect us from HIV infection. And the sea change that needs to happen is that people need to understand that sexually transmitted infections don't stay locked in little groups in society. They move from person to person, and that the only person who can protect you from acquiring HIV is you.
Do you think that message has gotten out effectively?
I think it has gotten out effectively a few times. It's not a durable message.
Mm-hmm. And just needs to be reinforced.
It needs to be reinforced and reattenuated and made as appealing to my 15-year-old, for example, as it is to me, or as real to my 15-year-old as it is to me.
Do you think the younger people, teenagers, early 20s perhaps, are at more risk as they become sexually active?
Not necessarily at more risk than the rest of society, but then anybody who's sexually active and doesn't protect themselves is at risk.
I see. Do you think that outreach programs and information programs should be targeting any particular segments of society, age-wise or socioeconomically?
Sure. People of reproductive age, and we got to not forget that that includes people into their 80s. One population that we've forgotten to educate that's turning up with cases of HIV infection, not huge numbers, but occasional cases, are people between the ages of 55 and 80 who have a new sexual partner, have not grown up in an era where they talked about sexual history or prevention kinds of things, so they go along believing that everything's going to be fine and are surprised by HIV infection. I think the other big notion that has to get into people's heads is this is viruses transmitted heterosexually in both directions. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. People have to move out of their denial about that.
Getting back to patients, Robin, what about the treatment of the opportunistic of infections we've been talking about that end up being such huge problems for patients? Are those being kept under better control today, and have treatments improved when they do develop?
Treatments have improved markedly, and the numbers of days that patients spend in the hospital have gone way down because we can give many patients prophylaxis against common infectious agents that, if their immune systems weren't working, would make them really sick. But the best development in managing opportunistic infections has been the highly active antiretroviral therapy, the things that keep your immune system functioning normally so that you aren't susceptible to infection.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about diagnosis. We discussed the new test that was pretty much discovered and developed right here in the Triangle. What else is going on in the world of diagnosis these days?
There are rapid tests, saliva and rapid blood tests that can give folks results sooner than the traditional 2-week wait to send your blood sample into the state lab. If one of those tests is positive, your provider should draw blood and go ahead and send it into the state lab for confirmation. But that kind of screening test offers an opportunity to reach out to folks who might not come into medical care centers for any reason, because they're young and healthy and they don't think of themselves as needing that, mm-hmm. or they don't have insurance and couldn't access care if they wanted to, and gives us a way to educate and screen folks that we didn't have access to before. So that's a huge and very positive development.
I see. What kind of rate of false positives or false negatives would come with those rapid screening tests?
They're about 99% sensitive and specific. They're really good. So
that's amazing.
The likelihood, I think, is more in the direction of false negative, but not. But again, a really tight tolerance that those tests were developed under.
I see. So the next step of sending in the blood sample to the state lab, that would be an actual culture test. Is that how it works?
No, it's a assay to detect the presence of antibodies, so that you don't culture the virus. Mm-hmm. You can measure viral level RNA, and that's a regular test that we do on patients enrolled in CARE to see if their therapy is effective. And it's also the test that we use to screen for acute HIV infection. But it's an expensive test, and so we don't make it universally available unless you're going to need it to attenuate your medical care.
I see. I know that one of the measures of how a patient is faring is what they call viral load. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Literally measuring the number of virus particles that the person is carrying. And that in some cases of people who are compliant with their therapy and doing everything they should be doing, that viral load can actually be reduced to below detectable levels. Are those the people that are living with this disease in relatively successful fashion?
Absolutely. And they are less infectious to others, but not completely uninfectious to others. And one of our big education messages is, just because your viral load is not detectable in your blood doesn't mean that you don't have virus in other compartments of your body, your lymph system, your central nervous system, that could reinfect your bloodstream if you don't continue on your therapy.
We talked about that a little bit, and I wanted to ask you a little bit more about another study I found when I was researching for our conversation this morning, that suggests that although there has been a substantial increase in high-risk behavior among gay men since 1996, when heart therapy came along, that apparently, this, according to this study, that has actually started to level off a little bit, but that today an increasing number of HIV-positive men are using the Internet to look for sexual partners and doing what the researchers refer to as serosorting, or finding other HIV-positive men online for unprotected sex. And the researchers suggest that that is still highly risky behavior. Have you heard about that?
I have heard about it, and actually, again, that research is being done by Research Triangle Institute and Family Health International here in the Triangle.
I see.
I think both have projects taking a look at those behaviors. The worry there is superinfection, that if you become infected with a strain of virus that's resistant to medications that you may be on, that you're not resistant to, you will become you will acquire resistance in your virus to medications. So you become harder to treat and your options for therapy shrink. And we may not be able to develop new therapies fast enough to keep up with what you need. So we really recommend safer sex, even if both members of the couple are HIV positive.
So it's not a time to let down your guard if you are actually living successfully with the disease and have it under control.
That's right.
I see. We are actually already nearing the end of our time together, and I certainly do not want to let our time run out without talking about the worldwide pandemic, Robin. Has there been any progress at this point in bringing the skyrocketing rates of HIV and AIDS in the underdeveloped world under control?
The huge progress has been in making treatment available in places where no one 5 years ago would have believed that treatment could be made available. The 3x5 project that WHO just ended at the end of last year didn't manage to enroll 3 million people, but it did manage to enroll 1.8 million people around the world.
Was the 3x5 project?
It was an initiative by the World Health Organization and a number of partner agencies and countries to try to get 3 million people with HIV in the developing world on antiretroviral therapy by the end of 2005.
I see.
And the problem became just the economy of scale up actually, that you couldn't develop health services fast enough in some places to get that amount of medication out to places where it needed to be gotten. I think the upside in the international epidemic is a lot more honesty around the world about rates of HIV infection. For example, the Chinese epidemic has come out of its closet in the last 2 years. Again, a tremendous generosity of sharing effective approaches. The downside is prevention is as difficult in the developing world as it is in the developed world. It's really hard for people to change their personal behaviors and maintain those changes without lots and lots of social support. And this is still a terribly stigmatized disease.
Sure. Are there any particular areas or countries that you're aware of where things are actually working to reverse the pandemic?
Thailand is often touted as a model country for taking a nationalized and very public approach to managing HIV. And because they have a huge sex industry, there's maybe been a pathway to have that conversation publicly that might not exist in other places. Uganda, again, the president of Uganda said, HIV is happening in my family. This is about all of us. This is in contrast to South Africa, where resistance to importing antiretrovirals from elsewhere in the world seems to have slowed treatment there. So it varies. And the neat thing about AIDS is this model that people meet at least every 2 years and share what's new at the international conference, and that there is sharing is a central value toward managing the epidemic.
Sure. When is the next international conference scheduled?
I don't know.
Okay.
They've been in places that have been too expensive for me to go.
Well, I seem to recall the last one was last year, so I guess
Thailand, so it'll be another year.
Another year out. I know that a lot of important information has come forth from each and every one of those.
And what's nice is there's
still...
it's
been a way to take the pulse, too, of,
exactly.
of what's going on.
And advocates and people living with HIV are thought of as integral partners at those meetings, that it's not just scientists talking about the current recipe for treatment. It's also how do we manage the real social problems and political problems that arise around the epidemic, and what are we all going to do together about that?
Sure. Robin, I wanted to ask you about another really fairly disturbing report I saw recently. It was a piece of research that stated that even if antiretroviral therapy was made universally available in the poorer countries, that not only would not stop the epidemic, but could actually result in an increase in the number of people infected with HIV. Had you heard about that?
I haven't heard about that. I think the worry is now that we've developed cheap enough, easy enough to take therapies for initial therapy in the developing world, what are we going to do when people need second and third line drugs that are much more expensive or much harder to take? But I haven't heard the anxiety that the notion that you can treat and cure AIDS is going to add to its spread.
The logic that they were using was something that people would take it less seriously and go right back into risky behaviors, and that it would actually end up, as I say, according to them, potentially increasing the numbers, which is seems counterintuitive. But
we don't hear much from women around the world with HIV yet. They're affected very largely. And as they stay in relationships of economic dependence, they stay at high risk. So perhaps the change in how we value what gets exchanged for sex around the world, both here and elsewhere, will make an impact on prevention.
Indeed. Well, are the risk factors today the same ones as they've always been? Unprotected sex, injection drug use, etc.?
Yep. The virus lives in blood cells, white blood cells. There are lots of white blood cells in blood, semen, and vaginal secretions. So if you're exchanging those with someone else, and they're infected, you're likely to become infected as well.
I see. And where do you see your program to get back to your world? Where do you see it going over the next few years?
I really hope that the capacity to treat folks at accessible primary care clinics is maintained in the federal funding scheme, and that we can encourage new young professionals to come join this work and to see it as a great laboratory for learning about infectious diseases and about human behavior. And there's plenty of work sort of for everybody to do. I think we will continue to try and attenuate the clinical skills, particularly of non-physicians, because physicians have access to lots of opportunities for education, and they can travel more often. Mm-hmm. We tend to bring our training as close to the practice site as possible, so that nurses and other clinicians who can't travel and leave can feel that they really have the opportunity to learn from experts without having to leave home, close clinic, etc.
I see. Well, Robin, we are just about out of time for Radio in Vivo this week. Certainly want to thank you for coming in, and it's been a very educational hour.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
We've been talking this morning with Robin Swift of the North Carolina HIV/AIDS Training Center. And I hope you will join us again next week on Radio in Vivo at this same time. My guests next week will be Barry Teeter and Dr. Maria Raposa of the North Carolina Biotechnology Center. We're going to be talking about the center itself, which has helped make North Carolina a real biotechnology hotspot. For better or worse, depending on how you feel about that, and the amazing world of biotechnology itself, which of course is increasingly affecting all of our lives, again, for better or worse. And we will get into all of that next week, and I do hope you will make a point to tune in. Thank you for listening to Radio in Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. See you next week.